So we've heard a lot from Ruth about how to do tree level calculations in a modern way, and also some from Nima mixed in with applying some of those ideas to computations in n=4, also for computing the integrands at loop level. Today I want to take a somewhat orthogonal point of view and show how to compute, or at least build the basis for computing loop amplitudes in a way that ultimately is something that we can apply to LHC physics and not just to specialized theories like n=4. So more generally, if we're talking about the whole class of techniques known as on-shell methods, then the basic idea is that we're going to compute all physical quantities from a basic interaction which is, in the case of a gauge or gravity theory, just a three-point amplitude. If there are higher dimension operators, you might have sort of irreducible higher point amplitudes. And using only information from physical on-shell states. And at least morally speaking, although maybe we're not quite there, we don't really need a Lagrangian. And the other sort of general, feel free to interrupt incidentally. The other general philosophical idea in this program is to take properties, general properties of amplitudes in field theory, and to turn them into tools for actually doing calculations. So the thing that we've seen a lot thus far is factorization, which in turn gives us the BCFW on-shell recursion relations. And what we're going to look at today and next time is unitarity, which gives us the unitarity method. And finally, we are relying on the fact that there is an underlying. Yeah, I should. All right, let me. Is the unitarity line still visible to people?
That's okay.
All right. And we are going to rely on the fact that there's an underlying field theory which is what gives us a basis of integrals. In a sense, this is the fact that we have Feynman integrals is, in some sense, the one last remaining link to Lagrangian. Of course, you could just take it as a given that that's the set of objects you start with, but it's most naturally understood as originating from a Lagrangian. So the basic formalism, sort of the master equation, is the following, and this is maybe the most important equation to retain if you're here to surf rather than to actually learn any of the technology, is that we can write the amplitude as a sum over a certain basis set of integrals, of Feynman integrals, there are coefficients which are rational functions, and then there might be, in some theories, additional rational terms. And see if I can find a color here that will erase properly. So the coefficients and the rational terms are precisely rational functions of spinner variables, of the external spinners. And in contrast, the integrals have branch cuts. They have discontinuities. And it's these coefficients which we're going to calculate directly by unitarity, in fact, in four dimensions. And I may or may not get to talking about the rational terms next time around. Now, one way of looking at this equation is maybe the experimenter's viewpoint on it, which is to say that we have some black box, and inside this black box, there are theorists who do these computations. Of course, the theorists know that what's actually sitting inside this box is typically some graduate student who's usually undernourished. And somewhere inside this box, there's a table and a PC, and maybe a copy of some field theory book. I suppose I should point to Michael's book. And one of the questions that we want to ask is, what tools can we provide this graduate student to actually do the computations?
Are there any pens and pencils inside the box?
I'm sorry?
Are there any pens and pencils inside the box?
Well, yeah, I suppose we can give him a pencil or two. Although these days, really, people should be doing everything either on their tablets or on their PCs, right? Now, there are some variants in sort of parallel developments. In particular, there are techniques that Nima has talked about yesterday for constructing integrands via a recursion. And this is, at least in the details, kind of special to n equals 4. There's also approaches to constructing integrands. And of course, once with the explicit integrands, you can then turn them into amplitude via unitarity. And these are known as the OPP methods. And I think at least one of OPP is Roberto is sitting there. So with apologies to OPP, I am not going to discuss this at all in my lectures. I'm going to focus on a slightly different version. And we're going to focus on techniques for calculating these coefficients directly. So what do we know about unitarity as a general property in field theory? So are there any questions before I go on? Are there any questions about the master formula?
Rational is a function, is a Hermitian formula also?
Rational is a rational function. Since it's just directly a function of the spinners, then it's not necessarily associated with integrals. In fact, certain techniques for computing it do actually associate with integrals, and you could imagine doing it again by summing over the associated integrals. But for the purposes here, you're going to treat it as one object. And as is the case, something again I'm not going to discuss, as is the case with rational, general rational expressions, if you know something about their factorization, you can set up a BCFW-like recursion for computing those terms. And that is one of the approaches that people have used. So unitarity just says that probability is conserved. And that's, I suppose, version minus one of the unitarity method. And I suppose I could stop the lecture here and tell you all to go out and work out the consequences. But if we write the S matrix in terms of, I think, what's at least in condensed matter known as the transfer matrix, then we find a more suggestive version of this equation. Or if I'm identifying the left-hand part now as the imaginary part in a certain sense, depending on phase conventions of this non-trivial part of the scattering matrix, not necessarily the forward part, then I find something that intrinsically has the right structure to relate different orders in perturbation theory. So if we imagine that we're first going to be getting non-trivial imaginary part at one loop, then we can imagine relating that to something which is a product, in some sense, of tree amplitude squared. And that's basically, with refinements, is the way that the unitarity method is working. So if we put in the Feynman I epsilon, then we can say something like the discontinuity of T is going to be given by T dagger T. Of course, what I mean by discontinuity here is just the usual discontinuity in the complex plane. So if we look at some term in an amplitude, we might have, for example, log minus S over minus T in a four-point amplitude. And if we take typically T less than 0, and we look at the S plane, then there will be a branch point at S equals 0, and then there will be a branch cut along the positive real axis. And it's really just this discontinuity that we want to compute. Now, in absent any other knowledge, which ultimately is going to be supplied by the fact that we have a basis of integrals, then that's not the only thing we want to know, of course. We don't just want to know the discontinuity. We also want to know the absorptive part of the amplitude, so not just the I pi here, but also the logarithm itself. And the idea is that in the abstract, this is being supplied by dispersion relations. And in fact, you can even do this explicitly. It's not the way an efficient machinery will actually be working. So one of the key things that we do want to keep in mind here is that, of course, we're ultimately interested in an efficient way of doing it. And there are different measures of efficiency. First of all, there's people efficiency. How much human time does it take to get to an answer? And then there's also the efficiency when we finally turn over a piece of code that we've written using maybe some calculation. It doesn't really matter how the calculation was done. How efficient is that in the hands of the experimenters? And if it takes a day to generate a distribution, that's probably OK. If it takes a year, then they're not going to be very interested. So more generally, we're going to use the fact that, or we're going to apply the idea that amplitudes should be determined by their analytic structure. And this here is what one might call version zero of the unitarity method. So the next thing we want to understand is how to translate this more concretely into objects that we can actually calculate explicitly. And since we're ultimately going to be making use of Feynman integrals, and also in order to link with sort of more traditional methods of doing these calculations, then we should ask, how do these equations translate into Feynman integrals? And the answer, in fact, was given long ago by what are known as the Kutkusky rules. And these date from the 1960s. They are textbook material. I don't remember. Are they in your textbook, Michael?
It's defined.
Okay. And but it's maybe not something that everyone has at the back of their mind. So what Dick Kutkusky told us is that if we want to take the discontinuity, not just at one loop, but of some general loop amplitude, then we should perform a certain operation called a cut. Now, one can take discontinuities in different channels. In general, of course, in some multi-particle amplitude, you'll have a different invariance. So in some six-point amplitude, you'd have, let's say, S12, S23, S34, S123, and you can take the discontinuity in each of those channels, since there may be logarithms or more complicated functions in each of those channels. And what he tells us is that we have to sum over all the cuts that isolate k, the momentum k on one side of the diagram, and we're supposed to form a certain interference and what we're supposed to do when we cut one of these propagators is replace the propagator with the Feynman I epsilon here, indicated actually by an I delta, in order to avoid confusion with dimensional regularization. We're supposed to replace that propagator with a delta function, which is also restricted to positive energy. And when we do that, if we take our original, let's say in this case, one loop Feynman integral, then we'll have some set of propagators going around the loop. And is this line still visible here? Okay. So we're just going to put in the relevant delta functions. And we can now rewrite this in a slightly more suggestive way by introducing another momentum. Let me relabel L as P1, and essentially L minus K as P2.
Sorry, is this many terms here?
Or there's a single, well, I mean, it's a single Feynman integral. Imagine it being a Feynman integral for a phi cubed theory.
Yeah, the next for the next line down here. Is that
this is a product.
Propagators, sorry.
And then there's, I haven't, all the other propagators, which I omitted as dots here, are also omitted as dots over here. So now I'm going to move, I'm going to rewrite, actually let me rewrite this also by moving some other stuff around. So I've just basically, I've now taken L minus K and relabeled it as P. And what we can see now is that this over here is, of course, just the Lorentz invariant phase space measure. So imagine we're doing some phase space integral. It's just the phase space measure that would be relevant if we were, for example, doing the decay of some particle with momentum k. It's a decay into two particles. Or if we were doing, as it is in this case, a scattering of some number of momenta whose total momentum is k into two particles. And the object we're going to get from all the denominators is simply a product of two tree diagrams, the tree diagram on the left-hand side with its set of propagators, and on the right-hand side with some other set of propagators. So basically, this discontinuity is simply going to be some phase space integral times one tree diagram and times another tree diagram. Now, this is already much better than version zero, because these tree diagrams, we actually know how to compute explicitly. If we have, in this case, let's say, imagining a phi cube theory, then it's basically just the propagators. If it were some other theory, you know, QCD, then we would have other Feynman rules, and diagram by diagram, we would be able to form this object, and of course, a phase space integral, we know how to do. Now, there's a number of problems. Yes.
But you have to change the I epsilon to the I deltas on one side, right?
If you were going to proceed by doing this by dispersion relations, yes. But since we're actually going to avoid doing that, I can be sloppy about it. So let me be sloppy about it. So there's a number of issues here. One is that we're doing this diagram by diagram. Another is that, as indeed suggested by the question, we don't really have the absorptive parts. The only thing we've really calculated here is the discontinuity. Something that I didn't really emphasize, but was not too shocking in something that's coming out of the 1960s, is that everything here is done with massive particles. And if we want to go to massless, then there are going to be lots of divergences to do something about. And finally, I've looked here at a single channel. I mean, I've picked some particular channel, and I know how to compute the discontinuity in that channel. But there are many channels. And there's the question of how do we ultimately put these things back together. It's also not exactly clear what the relation to the master formula is here, because I just have lots and lots of Feynman integrals floating around. So, but so let's start to tackle these problems. So the first thing we can do is sum this equation over all diagrams. So now I want to spend a few minutes thinking about doing a Gedanken calculation using Feynman diagrams. So we're not actually going to do it this way, but imagine that we had some black box that was able to do these calculations. So if we sum over all diagrams, then of course on the left-hand side we now get an amplitude. And I'm going to denote that object here by, in this case of a one-loop amplitude, by a shaded torus. And this thing is not exactly the sum of all the So the point is that I need to now add in diagrams which actually don't have the relevant propagators. So what I'm doing here is I took a diagram which had these two propagators and I replaced them with a delta function. But of course, in general, in the amplitude, I now have diagrams which don't have those propagators. So what's happening there? Well, what's happening there is that, let's say if we have some constant in that channel one or both of the propagators is missing, we simply multiply and divide by the propagator. And then for the denominator, we follow Kutkusky's rule. And that's simply going to give us an object which vanishes. So in other words, it's perfectly harmless to include diagrams which don't have the propagators. They simply won't give us a contribution to the discontinuity in this channel. That's also a sign that in general, from the discontinuity in a single channel, we cannot recover the entire amplitude, because there will be terms which simply are giving no signs of life in any given channel. So once we've done that, we've added in the diagrams which don't have the cut, then in fact, we now have a sum, a complete sum over the diagrams on the right-hand side. And we now have essentially the equation which is much more useful for us, which says that the discontinuity of the one loop amplitude is going to be given by a product of two tree amplitudes. And again, where we isolate k, this is a k to 2 and then a 2 to k, tree amplitude, or two to some other number. This is two to, if everything is minus outgoing, and this is some number m and m prime of momenta. So
that is something that the original equation.
Yeah, I'm just rewriting it in terms of formulas that one can actually compute explicitly.
And integrated over phase space.
Integrated over phase space, yes.
Exactly, imaginary t equals t over t.
That's what I just said.
Yes. So as I said, I could have actually stopped the lecture over here and told you it's over. I'm sorry? Well, as I said at the beginning, the people here from the Amplitudes program are probably not going to learn anything. So I'm sure you're one of them. Okay, so now what we can do here is just the number of particles. K is the momentum.
M to 2 and 2 to M.
Yeah, yeah. The momentum K. If you like, I should have interchanged these two lines. So what we can do now is to reverse this process. So we want to, instead of going this direction, we want to go the other direction. So we're going to start with a product of two tree amplitudes. We're going to replace this by write it out in terms of the two delta functions. More space here. And I'm going to move to the massless case. And yes, there are divergences here. I will take care of that as we move on. And now what we're going to do is move backwards. So we're going to replace these delta functions with propagators. So if we're working in a gauge theory, then of course there should be helicity projectors associated with these propagators. That's the usual way we think about them. But in fact, those helicity projectors are present in the tree amplitudes, because these have specific helicities. And we, of course, need to sum. In addition to doing the phase space integral, there's an implicit sum over the helicities. When we take the convention that all momenta are outgoing, then that means that, of course, if we flip the sign of a momentum, we're also flipping the sign of a helicity. So generically speaking, if we're now sewing things together, we have some tree amplitude. Then if we have a positive helicity here, we have to sew it together with a negative helicity there. And likewise, let's say a negative helicity here gets sewn together with a positive helicity. And it's summing over these helicities that will reconstruct the appropriate helicity projector that usually in field theory we think of as being associated with the propagator. So we now have a loop integral. And one of the things you might worry about is that, of course, there's an ambiguity here, because I went from an on-shell object to an off-shell object. And in particular, I'm still using an on-shell expression for the tree amplitude. When I sew things back together, the spinners, let's say if I'm expressing these tree amplitudes in terms of spinners, will form momenta. And that you can see because the overall little group scaling is going to be such that if the lambda scale one way and the lambda tilde scale the other way, then there'll be no overall scaling, so we can form them back into momenta. And then that momentum, we can simply naively extend from on-shell massless to off-shell. So what's going to happen is that the off-shell terms, of course, are going to cancel either this propagator or that propagator. And as we've seen earlier, those terms simply don't contribute to this discontinuity. So now that we've gone back to actually a contribution to the loop amplitude, strictly speaking, there may be additional terms that have no discontinuity in the channel that we started with, and those terms are not guaranteed to be right. So the only terms that we really should be retaining are the terms that have a discontinuity in the appropriate channel. Now, in general, what we have here, there'll be some numerator polynomial in L. The various denominators, some of which will be independent of L and will depend only on the external momenta, and some of them will depend on L, we can form those back to give propagators. I'm not actually going to go through an example with this version of the unitarity method, but there are examples in the old literature. And what we have to do now is to do various reductions, integral reductions, in order to then find out what our basis integrals are, if we don't know them ahead of time, and what the coefficients are. So we still have some algebra, which we really have to do symbolically or analytically. It's not something that in this form one can do purely numerically. So we do those integral reductions, and those integral reductions we would do in the same way as the more general integral reductions I'll talk about in a few minutes.
I'm sorry.
Yes?
You're slightly confused. So when you do it this way?
Yes.
How do you get back the real part? Because from that, you only get the two times imaginary
part.
No.
So the point is that this is where, in some sense, something sneaky has happened. Instead of actually using the dispersion relations explicitly, what we've taken advantage of the fact is that we know that the final answer has to be expressed in terms of some set of Feynman integrals.
So in other words, this allows you to get back the integrand.
Well, this is getting, this at this level, you can think of it as getting back the integrand, and then after you do these various reductions, various algebraic manipulations on the numerator, then you can identify the integrands of the different integrals that that will arise.
Not that you take the discontinuity of the
mathematical. Well, I mean, that's one way of also, you can also do it that way. You can think of it as manipulating, at this level, you can think of it as manipulating the integrand if you prefer, and then identifying which Feynman integrals are present. And of course, the Feynman integrals have the correct relation between the discontinuity and the absorptive part, and that also answers the question that that Brian asked earlier. Now, it is in fact possible, and some people have done it, to actually carry out the dispersion integrals explicitly and reconstruct the amplitude, reconstruct all the functions that go into the amplitude explicitly. But that's a much more laborious way of doing it. And the idea here is to try and minimize the amount of work you do. And since the integrals, in some sense, are known quantities, at least at one loop, then that's the way we want to go.
David, when I calculate the tree amplitude,
yes,
you depends on momentum there, right?
Yes.
So I should use the on-shell momentum rate?
So the point is that at this level, we are doing this symbolically, not numerically. Okay? This is a key point at this level. So I have, for example, you know, I might have some amplitude, if it's an MHV amplitude, that depends, for example, on the two-loop momentum in this fashion. And I'm going to have some compensating object in terms of brackets, let's say, in the other tree amplitude. Okay, I'm going to put them together. Actually, let me just write an example like so. Okay, so at this level, thus far, these manipulations I could do sort of indifferently, really, from a practical point of view, before or after doing this promotion step. But conceptually, let me think of doing it before I do the promotion step. So at this level, everything L2 squared is still 0. Okay? In this form, once it's given in terms of L2 dot something, then I'm perfectly free to take L2 to not be on shell. And the point about the earlier discussion of the discontinuity-free pieces is that that's going to change the answer for the loop integral, but it's going to change it in a way that does not change the discontinuity in the channel that we're examining. And again, you have to be able to manipulate the integrand symbolically in order to be able to do this. But when we get to generalized unitarity sometime next week, then it will be clear how to avoid this particular requirement. So the one thing that happens here is that, of course, there are going to be some integrals that arise, and we're actually going to do a survey of all the integrals that arise in a few minutes. But there are going to be some integrals that arise. For example, there might be some bubble integrals that arise. These things depend on only a single kinematic invariant. So these things only have a discontinuity in that one channel. So if I reconstructed a bubble, then for that particular contribution, I'm done, because I won't have added anything in some other channel. In contrast, and there'll only be one channel in which I can find this bubble. So if I'm looking in some other channel, let's say T instead of S, and then I'm supposed to throw this particular bubble away, if I'm looking in the K-squared channel, then I simply retain the coefficient, this bubble along with its coefficient. On the other hand, there are also going to be integrals that have discontinuities in multiple channels, and a box integral with one mass on an external leg is an example of that. This actually has discontinuities in three channels. There's an S channel, there's a T channel, and there's also a discontinuity in the channel representing the mass of the box. So here, one can imagine extracting this coefficient by, for example, looking at the S channel or looking at the T channel. And what I'm supposed to do is, when I've identified a specific integral, is I'm supposed to take its coefficient only once. That is, I'm supposed to look for it only in one channel. If you want to compute more than one channel, then you should find that the coefficients in the two channels agree. Otherwise, you've made a mistake in your calculation. So you can either use it as a cross-check or simply reduce the amount of work you have to do by looking for the more complicated integrals in only one of the channels that they have a discontinuity. So we now have something that gives us back the absorptive parts. It does it for amplitudes. We have a way of handling the fact that there are many channels and merging the answers together. On the other hand, we've added a new problem, which is that we still have various reduction, a lot of reduction algebra left to do. And that's something which ultimately so-called generalized or maximal unitarity will solve for us.
But there's an assumption here that there's an enumerable basis of integrals.
Now, strictly speaking, let me answer that question by saying some things which probably won't make sense until the end of the next lecture, which is that you can look at this sort of basic unitarity and then generalized unitarity and maximal unitarity. And until you get to maximal unitarity, in fact, you don't strictly speaking care about how tight your basis of integrals is. It can be looser or tighter. And it's really only when you want to do maximal unitarity numerically that the existence of a completely non-redundant basis becomes important. So one simple answer to the question is, if you're doing, let's say, calculations up to some finite number of external legs, then the basis of integrals is enumerable to begin with. And if you want to do calculations with an arbitrary number of external legs, then yes, you would like not just an enumerable, but in fact a finite basis, and at least one in, well, at least, well, I would say by now, actually, that's known to exist to all loop orders. So you have it. What's trickier is to get a basis which is demonstrably non-redundant. That's a less trivial problem, to which explicit solutions are only known at one in, or at least have only been proven at one in two loops. So these questions are all good, because that brings us to the next subject, which is the subject of integrals and integral bases. And that's something which we need to flesh out a little bit more. And we also need to take care of the question of all the divergences that arise. So along with the comments about integral bases that I'm now going to make, one can call this sort of version one of the unitarity method. And it's actually the version that was used up to the early years of the previous decade in order to do a lot of calculations, and a lot of explicit calculations, some of which are, in fact, in use with and programs that are being used by LHC experimenters have actually been applied. So it's a technology that has actually proven itself in practice. So the next section is sort of a review of one-loop integrals. And again, this is, I think, very strictly a textbook material, although I'm not sure what textbook it actually appears in. So we want to ask ourselves the question of what integrals actually appear in our calculation. And let's be more specific and think about some pure non-abelian gauge theory, so no fermions. We just have the gluons. And let's imagine we're computing some endpoint scattering amplitude at one loop. And ask ourselves, what integrals can appear? Well, there are three-point and four-point vertices. Again, I want to think about the Gedanken calculation using Feynman diagrams. And clearly, we're going to get the most possible propagators if we have all three-point vertices. So let's imagine constructing some integral of that sort. And if you think back to the three-point vertex, then of course it's linear in the momentum, and the momentum that could be appearing in there could be either an external momentum or it could be a loop momentum. So that means that generically, the kind of most complicated integral that we're going to get is something which at this level is ill-defined, but let me regulate it just by putting a little regularization symbol on it. And we could have one loop momentum at every vertex. There are going to be n different vertices, so we can have up to a tensor integral with up to n different powers of the loop momentum, and then we have all the various propagators. Now, of course, the loop integral, I mean, the amplitude itself, of course, is not a tensor object. This thing is dotted into some tensor expressed in the some external objects that depend only on the external spinners, so I can pull them out of the loop integral. And these are things which are either external momenta or objects built out of spinner strings. So they might, for example, include a reference spinner and one of the external spinners. Let me label it with R, for example. I should use the more popular notation here. And the first thing, and as in previous lectures, I'll use the notation that a sequence of indices in the implies a sum over the corresponding cyclically ordered external momenta. So the first problem is that this object, which I've written down in four dimensions, is horribly divergent. Some people might think about ultraviolet divergences, which are really kind of trivial at one loop and actually only arise in a limited subset of the integrals. Which really of much more concern to us are the infrared divergences. And for that purpose, and also, for controlling what ultraviolet divergences are there, then we're going to employ dimensional regularization, as is completely customary. And at least to my knowledge, the only way to really keep your sanity while doing complete calculations in gauge theories. Now, it turns out that there's another curious utility of dimensional regularization in the context of computing rational terms. So one of the subtleties in actually applying dispersion integrals explicitly, if one were to try and do it that way, is that these dispersion integrals don't necessarily converge, and then you have to do subtractions, at least if you're doing this in four dimensions. But if you are actually doing this in dimensional regularization, the dispersion integrals all converge, and you don't have to do subtractions anymore. And that, in turn, means that this gives you a handle on computing the rational terms, which statement I may or may not have time to elaborate on in the next lecture. So, in principle, if we were doing some Feynman diagram calculation, and if we had imagined maybe doing the Feynman integral numerically, or even if we're doing it analytically, you can actually just do this integral. There's no particular reason that you need to worry about a basis or doing reductions or anything like that. But the general rule, of course, is that analysis, namely integration, is hard and algebra is easy. And that's, in some sense, true, even more true for a computer than it is for a human. So what we want to do is reduce as much of the analysis as possible in favor of algebra. And once we want to think about actually numerical implementations of unitarity, which is something we'll get to next time, then this actually becomes essential. So one of the key points in what we're doing here is that even though we're taking the loop integral to be d-dimensional, the external objects into which we're dotting these loop momenta are all taken to be strictly four-dimensional. And that's actually important. If you were doing a d-dimensional integral with, let's say, objects taken to be 10-dimensional, then your integral basis would change, and the integrals that I'm going to write down would not suffice to be a complete basis. So the first thing we can do is to pick a basis for these external objects, external vectors, and it's convenient to pick a basis that's some of the external momenta of the particular integral that we're examining. So for example, k1, k2, k3, and k4. In four dimensions, any five vectors are always going to be linearly dependent, so four basis vectors are sufficient, and we can express any of these as some sum over coefficients. We can actually write down explicit formula for the coefficients if anyone cares. And that means that the objects that actually show up in the numerator here are going to be dot products of the loop momentum with four of the chosen external momenta. And at this stage, we can, for example, rewrite L dot K2 as 1/2 of L minus K1 squared minus L minus K12 squared plus S12. And what's going to happen is that this is going to cancel one propagator denominator, this one is going to cancel another, and this one will cancel nothing. But in each of these terms, we're also going to lose one power of the loop momentum in the numerator. So we can now set up a recursive procedure whereby we reduce an endpoint J rank integral to simpler integrals. So it's going to give us a sum of n minus 1 point integrals with rank 1 less. Along with some endpoint integrals, again with the rank reduced by 1. Now, these n minus 1 point integrals, of course, their external arguments are now in general massive, and those massive arguments are simply sums of the original external massless momenta. So even if we're starting in a pure non-abelian gauge theory, all the external particles of our amplitude are massless, the arguments to some of the integrals that we'll end up with are sums of those, and so they will be massive in general. So if one iterates this procedure, then at least for integrals which have five or more external legs, then we're going to ultimately get rid of all the tensor integrals. Instead of using a basis for the lower point integrals, you can simply use a combination of Lorentz invariance and parity to effectively do the same thing. And the one remaining thing we have to do is to take the higher point scalar integrals, things that have no more powers of the loop momentum in the numerator, and simplify those. And for that purpose, it's convenient to introduce a so-called Gram determinant, which takes two sequences of vectors as arguments. And it's simply given by the determinant of the matrix of their inner products. And the utility of this object is that it vanishes if there's any linear relation between either the set on the upper row or the set on the lower row. Now, as I already mentioned, there's a linear relation between any five vectors in four dimensions. And again, the external momenta are strictly in four dimensions, even though the loop momentum is being dimensionally continued. So we can write down a very nice linear object that vanishes. And so in particular, it's also going to vanish if I insert it into the numerator of this integral. And what we can now do is simply expand this Gram determinant. It's some polynomial in the invariance and an invariance involving the loop momentum. We can, again, since everything the loop momentum is dotted into is now an external momentum directly. So let's imagine that for concreteness that we're looking at the six-point integral. Then all of the terms involving the loop momentum are going to be reduced in a fashion similar to this. That means that we're going to get a bunch of five-point integrals. The only thing that's a little bit non-trivial is to actually show that the surviving coefficient of the six-point integral is non-vanishing, but it is. You can show that numerically if you want to, or analytically. And the net effect of this equation is then to give us an equation for the hexagon that is summed, is a sum of pentagon integrals. And you can, of course, carry this out in terms of for higher point integrals as well, and then ultimately recursively reduce any integral with more than five external legs into some sum of pentagons. So now, in fact, we already at this stage have not just an enumerable, but in fact a finite basis. There's one more step that we want to take. And here there's, in some sense, at one loop, kind of a trivial distinction. At higher loop, it becomes more important between two different kinds of bases. So the question is, are we interested in a basis to all orders in epsilon, or are we just interested in a basis for the terms that we ultimately care about from a physics point of view? So if we have an amplitude, then we can write it in some sense, at least for the purposes of stopping at one loop, as the physical part of it, plus some terms which are of order epsilon or higher. And these terms which are of order epsilon or higher, we don't care about, at least if we're stopping at in the next to leading order calculation at this order in perturbation theory. There's a similar Gram determinant that we can write down in the case of the five-point integral. This particular Gram determinant, of course, is trivially vanishing for the five-point integral because K5 is simply related to the other four by momentum conservation, so there's no content in it. But there's another Gram determinant that we can write down, which is the following, where both lines are identical. This is now quadratic in the loop momentum. And one thing that we can notice is that suppose that L were in fact not d-dimensional but four-dimensional, then we would actually have five four-dimensional vectors. So there's necessarily a linear relation. So this grand determinant necessarily vanishes. So in fact, the only way that this thing can escape vanishing is by relying on the d-dimensional or epsilon components of the loop momentum. So this thing is of order epsilon.
What's the difference upstairs and downstairs?
No, it's the same. It's the same thing. L1234, L1234. I mean, the grand determinant is defined as a function of two sequences of vectors, which don't have to be the same. I mean, they could be the same. Here they are.
Why is it not identical to zero?
Why would it be identically zero? If L, for example, suppose we're working in six dimensions. Suppose, and then what we take K1, K2, K3, and K4 to have zero components in the fifth and sixth. The fifth and sixth components. So they're really four-dimensional vectors. But L is truly a six-dimensional vector. It has components in components four and five non-vanishing. Then this object is not vanishing.
Right, but what if you go to 4 minus 2 epsilon?
So 4 minus 2 epsilon.
Then it should be identical to zero.
No. 4 minus 2 epsilon, it's of order epsilon in a certain sense. Because the right way to think about D for dimensional regularization is actually infinite dimensional. So in other words, if you have some number of different vectors which are all d-dimensional, then there's sort of many different dot products which are non-vanishing and are independent quantities. So the sense in which this is of order epsilon is that it's only going to depend on the epsilon dimensional components. And if you're doing an integral which has no singularities, then that integral is necessarily of order epsilon. Now, if I take this object and I stick it in here, then the it's not completely obvious what happens, because this is an object which in general has infrared singularities. And at the beginning of the next lecture, we'll look at some of those infrared singularities more explicitly. But it turns out that this particular Gram determinant actually vanishes in all regions which contribute those infrared singularities. And because the infrared singularities are logarithmic, that vanishing is strong enough to prevent any cancellation, in some sense, an epsilon over epsilon from yielding a finite contribution. So in fact, this integral, as it turns out, is also of order epsilon.
You're talking specifically about the 5-point.
I'm talking specifically about the 5-point integral at one loop, yes.
Is that physical intuition for why this happens?
I'm not quite.
Because the momentum either goes to zero or the G vanishes when two of the momentum.
Right. So okay. So I mean, if you want me to give the telegraphic version of the argument, then of course the singularities of the integral arise when L is soft, or when L is collinear to one of the external momenta, or when the shifted L is soft. And in those regions, this Gram determinant vanishes. Now, those singularities, the fact that they're actually expressible in dimensional regularization at all, means that they're logarithmic. So if you have even a fractional power vanishing, because in general, the vanishing here is actually spinorial rather than linear, that's sufficient to kill the singularity.
It's component is a mass, right? And so when you have this mass around, it regulates everything.
That's one way of looking at it in one loop. I think at two loops and higher, it's better to think of it in this fashion. I mean, unless you want to, I mean, yes, in a sense, the things that are relevant. So in general, if you have multiple L's, right, then there's the Li squared, but the Li.Lj are all independent. And it's their independence is due to the fact you should really be thinking of the D as infinite from the point of view of counting the number of independent degrees of freedom rather than as just being epsilon away from four dimensions. It's only when you're actually integrating them that these invariants, the Li squared or the Li dot Lj, that is the epsilon components of them, really contribute something that's effectively of order epsilon. So let me conclude the lecture here by writing down the set of basis integrals that one ends up with. Yes?
Maybe I missed it, but I don't think you finished the argument. So G vanishes in the regions that give inference.
I wasn't actually intending to give the argument, which is why it probably sounds unfinished. But I stated the conclusion, yes. But if you like, I can give the argument too. The argument I have not gone through is to explain a little bit more in detail why the singularities are arising from regions where L, the loop momentum, is nearly on shell and soft or nearly on shell and collinear to the external momentum. But if you're willing to take that, okay, then so the danger is that I have something here that's morally speaking of order epsilon. And I have singularities. So in fact, I have a 1 over epsilon squared. So naively, you might think this integral is going to actually be not of order epsilon, but of order 1 over epsilon. But the point is that you're also canceling off all the divergences. Because this object is going to vanish sufficiently strongly to cancel off the divergence of the integral, to cancel off the singularity of the integral in all the regions which actually give rise to a singularity. And the singularity, if you want to think of it as being regulated by a small mass, for example, of the external legs, then it's logarithmic in those regulators. And in a sense, the very fact that it's detectable in dimensional regularization means it's really logarithmic. I mean, powers of epsilon are logarithmic singularities. So if I have something that's so if I have some singularity that's du over u, and I multiply this by square root of u, that's enough to kill off the singularity. This integral is, I mean, the integrand is still singular, but the integral is non-singular. So the conclusion is that I can now write I5 as, in fact, a sum over four boxes plus terms of order epsilon. And generically, when I'm stopping at one loop, I'm happy to throw away those terms of order epsilon.
Sorry, David, you proved it's not singular, but then why is, can't it just be of order or unity? Why does it have to be order epsilon?
Because it cancels off the singularity, but in some sense, the vanishing in four dimensions is in addition to the vanishing in the collinear regions. So the thing is that in the collinear regions in particular, it's vanishing strongly enough to still, or another way of saying it is that the collinear regions are not large enough when you have something that's finite there to give you a contribution. So this basis when I'm throwing away all the terms of order epsilon and amplitude, so for the four-point case there's just a four-point box where all the external legs are massless. But if we set that aside, then all the boxes that we encounter are going to have masses. They can have one mass. They can have two masses in two different configurations. This is the so-called easy two-mass box. And then there's also, if there's an easy one, there has to be a hard one as well. And three-mass boxes and four-mass boxes. So again, when I'm talking about masses in the context of the pure gauge theory, all the internal lines and all the internal propagators are understood to be massless, and the external masses are always sums of original momenta, and it's just because those sums are in general have an invariant. It's the invariant that really is the mass here, and that's also why you should think of there as being a discontinuity in that channel. This thing, for example, might be S12, and so there's in a 5-point amplitude, and so there's going to be a discontinuity there. And in addition, there's lower point integrals, triangles.
Does our argument suffice that we only need to consider rank zero tensors for the triangles?
I haven't done that part of the argument, but the answer is yes. And in a sense, so your objection is that I don't have a basis here. But what I said is then, and what you can do is that you can use Lorentz invariants to write in terms of some limited number of external momenta, and then by taking appropriate dot products and solving the equations, then you can show that basically you get the same result. And finally, there's just one bubble. There are no tadpole integrals in the massless theory. If we had massive particles, there would also be tadpole integrals. So we have these nine integrals. And next time, we'll start by studying this easy two-mass box integral in a little bit more detail to understand its structure. It's an integral, of course, that plays a very important role in the n equals 4 results, because basically if you know this integral, then you know the one-loop MHV result in n equals 4, and it's also, of course, the basic integral that appears in the BDS exponentiation ansatz. So let me stop here, and if there are any other questions, I can answer them, or at least try to.
Any more comments or questions? Okay, let's thank David again.